Hello, I'm Adrian Daub.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
Whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So Adrian, today we have a fun live episode recorded at San Francisco's own City Lights Books.
Yeah, shout out to Peter Maravellis and the folks there. It was a wonderful event. I love that space. I love that place. It's so legendary, right? Famous for its association with the Beats, but really sort of a motor, a big engine of the San Francisco art scene really since the 1950s. So total honor. Other fun fact though, our producer Mark Yoshizumi asked me to make sure I mentioned this. Other fun fact about the legendary City Lights Books, it abuts the Jack Kerouac Alley, which people, I think, play music shows at occasionally, as was the case the evening when we recorded this. Moira, do you want to set the scene for folks just to explain some of the audio issues they're going to be encountering?
Yeah, this is actually hilarious in a slapsticky kind of way, because we get there to launch Adrian's wonderful new book. Adrian and I were in conversation before a live audience at the legendary City Lights, and we get upstairs and the events person is like, listen, I'm really sorry. And we're like, what's going on? And he goes, so the bar across Jack Kerouac Alley, I think it's called Vesuvio.
I think so, yeah.
He's like, Vesuvio is hosting a punk band in the alley, and they will be playing directly below you, like right below the window. So Adrian and I conducted this conversation while shouting over punk music.
Yeah. So funny thing about the audio is you can't hear the punk music, but what you can hear is us shouting insanely.
No, we just sound like we're losing our minds. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what this is about. It's that you have to imagine someone thrashing maniacally, you know, raging against the machine, not like 12 feet away from us, maybe 15 feet away from us, and us sort of having to shout over it. But the funny thing is, as Peter from City Lights pointed out to us, like, none of that makes it onto the actual audio.
No, we just sound really, really mad.
It sounds like
mad.
We're shouting for no fucking reason whatsoever.
I think really that, like, as the music got louder and faster and more intense, it gave you this kind of perverse power. You were, like, really energized by it. And after a certain point, you were sort of like flailing your hands. You know, Adrian is like a kind of like personally reserved guy, for those of you not lucky enough to know him in person. And he really got into this Oz-like power from having the music playing beneath him. It was like some sort of dark magic going on.
It was definitely the most Jim Morrison-like I've ever felt giving a public performance. I'm thrilled that it was preserved. And we're thrilled that there are still punk shows being played in Jack Kerouac Alley. Like, this is what the Russian formalist critic Mikhail Bakhtin calls the polyphony, the heteroglossia. It's a buzzing confusion of voices, and we're all part of this wonderful democratic discordance, aren't we?
Thematically appropriate for your book, right? Because yeah. It's a book all about how the cancel culture moral panic tries to pathologize as wrong what is actually just, you know, the stuff of a democratic polity, right?
Yeah.
The marketplace of ideas.
Yeah, the people who disagree with each other sometimes shout.
And we definitely were competing in that marketplace of ideas with the punk band downstairs, but they did not cancel us.
Exactly. So we'll leave it at that. I hope you enjoy the conversation. We should also mention that, you know, we have our Patreon. Feel free to subscribe to that. Also, there are a couple of very fun episodes coming up for us. We have a busy December. The Kirsties are coming up soon. So
yes,
we're going to record with Michael Hobbs any day now.
If anybody remembers, last year we did our ranking of the most cursed gender and sexuality discourses of 2023. And I really feel that 2024 is going to be an even more robust Kirsties award season.
Bumper crop. Yeah. It feels like, you know, there's that scene in The Simpsons where Homer is sent to hell and he's forced to kind of gulp on like endless supplies of donuts. That's me and cursed discourses having to do with gender and sexuality in 2024. You know, Satan is like, oh, really? You have a podcast about this? Well, get a load of this shit.
that is our ironic punishment, right, from the classical hell. But yeah, please support us on Patreon. We've got great episodes there. It's funner and weirder and like kind of more vulgar than our already oh-so buttoned up main feed episodes.
I know.
So I think you'll have fun. We've got a great Discord going that's been a blast. And thank you just for being our listeners and for helping us along on this weird journey.
Thank you.
All right, here's the show.
Welcome to City Lights, everyone, especially to those of you online. Tonight, a very, very timely book, The Cancel Culture Panic, which is, of course, published by our friends over at the Stanford University Press. And we have some in the audience here tonight. Such a pleasure to have you both with us. Welcome to City Lights.
Thank you to everybody in the audience, both here at City Lights and online. I loved this book, and I so loved seeing this phenomenon of cancel culture and these fears about like discursive excess on the left that I have witnessed sort of shape the political discourses in my country for so long. I loved seeing it filtered through your analytical mind at great length, like much longer than the typical like tweet length quip,
right,
about cancel culture, because I feel like the standard line about cancel culture is that, you know, it's hypocritical, right? It's very selective. And what you do is you really establish it as a habit of conservative thought that allows what you call the moral entrepreneur, which is such a great phrase.
To
synthesize a lot of different anxieties and desires and ideas that might be in conflict ordinarily.
Yeah, I think that's right. So as Maura is alluding, there is a line of argument that basically cancel culture, the fear of cancel culture is a moral panic, that it kind of blows up these anecdotes to essentially further a conservative political agenda. And to some extent, my book thinks that too, but I kind of didn't want to stop there. I wanted to ask, well, how come that it works, right? Like how come, you could think of like the kind of panic over wokeness being kind of very similar. But if you meet someone at a dinner party and they're like, you know, what I really worry about is all that wokeness and the woke mind virus, right? Like you kind of know to tune them out. You know what you're going to get. This is going to be right-wing culture war stuff. Cancel culture is unusual because it does exist on the right, right? Like Ron DeSantis is obsessed with it. Donald Trump is obsessed with it. But this cancel culture warning did really not originate on the right and didn't really succeed first on the right. It really started more in the New York Times and the Atlantic, you know, in places where you don't get to see sort of anti-woke screeds all the time. And so this is part of why I thought this was an interesting kind of meme to trace, because I'm like, where does this come from? Where does this kind of uncanny success of this idea stem from? You know, I mean, I'm a literary scholar, and so I approach this to some extent as a study of text, a study of a genre. There is a kind of article that used to be written about cancel culture sort of between 2018 and 2022, I would say, right? Like it starts with three anecdotes. Two of them happened on a college campus. Then it makes like a comparison to McCarthyism. Then there's going to be something about a study from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Like I could basically write you one of these right now. I could sort of Mad Lib this for you. And the funny thing is that type of text did travel the globe. Like you could read stuff like that in the UK, read it in Germany, in France. You can even read them in places in Argentina and Chile. And at the same time, you wouldn't read them necessarily just in the Wall Street Journal. You would read them in the New York Times. You'd read them in the Washington Post. And they were appealing sort of not to the inveterate culture warrior in your family, but they were appealing to a worried liberal as well. And so I thought this is, to me, really sort of the figure for the Trump age, really, where, you know, like some kind of barrier between center right and far right is really breaking down. And where also the way everything seems to be networked now, right? That like, you know, Trumpism seems to sort of like travel the globe, and like anti-immigration sentiment sort of like keeps getting repeated, like that we kind of recapitulate what the UK did 5 years ago, or like the gender panic, which came from France to the United States. So it just seemed to me such a rich thing to kind of trace. So the fact that the description of cancel culture as an object isn't accurate and that the panic around it is a moral panic is kind of the premise of the book, not the main argument. The main argument is about what that shows about a particular moment and about the politics of that moment.
This might be a good moment for me to interject and explain to you that because Adrian is the hardest working person in the world, to a degree that's, you know, maybe a little bit insane. He actually wrote a version of this book in German for a German audience. And then instead of merely translating the book he already wrote, he in fact reconceived of the book to make it more legible to an American audience and then wrote it again in English. So we got a very nice blurb about Adrian's accomplishments here in California and at Stanford, but he's also a pundit for German language media. And for
my sins.
And something that is really interesting to me is, like, I feel like a lot of people who start critically engaging with cancel culture as a moral panic and start thinking about this discourse in American media and how it functions, it's because either they were subjected to some kind of cancellation or because they were accused of canceling others, right? So there's kind of a first person element of this, which bespeaks to its anecdotal, like, iterative nature. But you didn't come upon it that way.
Never been canceled. Yeah. I mean,
maybe tonight.
The night is young. The night is young.
But you started looking at this as a genre, and you really started looking at it how it was operating in an international global context.
Yeah. Well, I related to it as a producer, right? As you mentioned, I'm a bit of a pundit. And so basically I was asked to write these kinds of texts. And I would say, you know, they're like, don't you think that your students are becoming so authoritarian? And I'm like, I don't know. They're 19 years old. I don't think they're, I'm not sure how you get to be authoritarian if I get to grade you, right? But then they wouldn't like write me back. And then someone else would write the piece. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's what you wanted from me. And meanwhile, whenever I would talk to, you know, French audiences, German audiences, or went to the UK, people would ask me these questions that they seem to know the answers to already, often about my students. And I was like, well, I don't know. American students are pretty diverse. Like, I don't know if I know like what the university is like, what American students like as a group are like. I mean, how many millions of them are there, right? But they seem to know the answer. And I started getting fascinated with these texts that gave them that surety, that assurance that they knew what was amiss, right? They're like, well, what's wrong with kids at universities these days? I'm like, oh my God, what are you basing this on, right? Like, I taught something like 1,200 undergraduates a year, and I couldn't have generalized. Like, there's some things that are true for some of them. There are things that are true for others. But that kind of phantasmatic self-assurance really seemed to me like that's where a certain audience meets a certain kind of text, right? Like, you're operating in almost a fictional space, right? Like, anything we know with some degree of granularity is complicated. You know, whatever field you're in, like, is this true? Like, kind of. I mean, like, you kind of have to see, and then you go into a whole 5-minute description and people glaze over and get super bored. That's a sign of that you're an expert in that particular field, I would say. But there is this kind of security and safety that really, I think, comes from distance. And in the United States, a lot of stories about cancel culture on college campuses came from people who weren't at college campuses or who had left them, and it comes with living with stories, right? Our stories tend to be clearer in what they mean and what they communicate about the world than the messy reality we all live through. Now, I'll give you one example. I have one little bit in the book where I just kind of went down this rabbit hole to figure out, I don't know how many of you have read The Human Stain by Philip Roth, a wonderful novel from the year 2000, but I repeat, a novel from the year 2000, right? And you wouldn't believe the number of pieces in German, French, I think I saw one Argentinian, British newspapers that in 2021 would start their story about cancel culture at American universities with, like, we all remember the case of Coleman Silk from The Human Stain. And you're like, yeah, it's a little weird. Like, if I'm doing a piece about, like, a crime spike, and I'm like, we all remember the movie, you know, with Charles Bronson, right? It's like, first of, this movie is 40 years old. Second of, it's a movie, right? It's not a documentary. Like, how, like, and of course, the people writing the article knew that, but somehow there was a kind of comfort with fiction, right? Like, the fiction proved something to them that for something else, they probably would have asked for a thing that happened in the world, as opposed to a thing that a novelist came up with in the year 2000. And so this is what got me interested in the fact that, like, people felt very ready to judge from a great distance, and that they seemed extremely ready and willing to live with fictions, whether those fictions were open about the fact that they were fictions or they were these anecdotes that were so
obviously fake, right? Where you're like, this is just a story, you know?
So this, you alluded earlier to the genre of the cancel culture panic magazine piece, right?
Yeah.
This article that appeared, for me as a media watcher, it really did seem like a solidly once a week.
Yeah.
And it would either be in the Atlantic or it would be in the New York Times opinion section. Barry Weiss at the New York Times opinion section had this as her beat for a long time. Now that seems to have gone to Pamela Paul, who writes some version of this quite often. It might be in the New Yorker, or it might be in like the Washington Post, you know, a quite wide variety of right, but also center and center left publications.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that as a genre, they all rely heavily on these anecdotes, usually from campuses, to try and diagnose what they claimed was a larger social problem of censoriousness, of punitiveness, coming from the political left and often from young people. Right? Yeah. And it struck me that I had begun to read these pieces for their misrepresentations of those anecdotes, right? Yeah. And this is something you go into a little bit in the book. First of all, how these anecdotes were being collected very deliberately by right-wing organizations that were trying to seed these stories in the media. And then also how they were misrepresented, right? Yeah. How they would be not factual, but designed to evoke what the readers would feel would be like an emotional truth.
Exactly. I mean, like, there's two things you're kind of signing on to with one of these anecdotes. One is, should we do Oberlin Banh Mi?
Oberlin Banh Mi is the classic. Does anybody remember Oberlin Banh Mi?
So there was a story in, I want to say 2017, that undergrads at Oberlin had decried the serving of banh mi sandwiches, so Vietnamese sandwiches, at the cafeteria as racist, right? And like, you read that in a, on the one hand, you might say, that seems odd. I don't know if that's quite right. Turns out it is bullshit, but like
you might also think, oh, the youth frighten and disturb me.
It is a Rorschach test, right? Like, if you keep reading, if you're like, this is bullshit, I'm not going to read this, fine, that's not for you. But if you go past that, basically, you kind of have to just stipulate to the fact that this allegedly happened, right? And the two things that you don't normally do are ask who says and how come we know about this, right? How is it that a story about dietary preferences at a Ohio liberal arts college,
with like 1,500 students.
Yeah, maybe, something like that, right? Tiny. Made it all the way to a national publication. How did this writer in Washington, D.C. learn of this? And how come I am now hearing about it? Those are the questions that you sort of have to mute if you want these kinds of anecdotes to work for you. I mean, I'll give you an example, another example from Stanford. I was handed a Christmas present by the Wall Street Journal because the Wall Street Journal reported that Stanford had banned the use of the word American. And it's exactly this kind of thing. I'm like, I feel like I would have heard. I feel like that would have stood out in my inbox, right? Like, someone please clean up the fridge in the rec room. Dear professor, can have an extension. Also, please don't use the word American. And like, it would have stood out. I didn't get that email. And so I sort of sighed and I started kind of looking into what the hell happened here. What had happened here was, in that particular case, that our IT department, so not the computer science department, mind you, but like the people who
fix our computers when they break,
had, under the impression of Black Lives Matter in 2020, decided, what if we go over the way we design our websites, the kind of boilerplate texts we put on those websites, and what if we remove certain language from our code? Because it turns out that apparently programmers refer to slave and master documents. And they were like, well, what if we not use that language anymore? Right? That list that they'd come up with.
An in-house style guide for their back-end
something like
code.
That. Yeah. It was on a Slack channel for like 6 months and no one looked at it until it somehow wound up in the Wall Street Journal. It is a thing of beauty, I do have to say. Like, it was just clearly like, there are no bad ideas kind of thing, because it had some words where you're like, well, if that's on our website, we probably should shut down our website. Like, the N-word's on there and you're like, well, I would hope that that's not on any Stanford website, right? But so is the word Karen, where you're like, well, feels hard to avoid with a faculty of several thousand people. We're going to have some Karens. No hate, but like, there's going to be just some literal Karens out there. But that's the thing. Like, you had to kind of dig down into like, who did what to whom? And then the second question was like, how, and this is the question I never was able to figure out, like,
how did the Wall Street Journal get this, right? I have my theories. I'm not going to say, but like, it's very noticeable that a person who's like, I can't believe those wokesters at Stanford, right? Like, has to not ask themselves, like, wait, why am I hearing about this? Like, how did this get to me?
Which might bring me to something you identify as a real telling feature of the cancel culture panic genre, which is this kind of like motivated disproportionality, right? Yeah. Like these tiny incidents where the motivation is not what's being presented and really the stakes could not possibly be any lower,
right. Yeah.
Is being blown up into quite literally a national scandal. What are the mechanisms that make it travel that far?
The mechanisms are sort of association and comparison, right? Like, this is where you get like, oh, this is like the McCarthy era, right? Like, Steven Pinker is very fond of that comparison, right?
And sometimes they use the Dreyfus Affair.
The Dreyfus Affair. There's a piece by Peggy Noonan from 2021 about cancel culture showing a bunch of Chinese kids from the Cultural Revolution being like, now comes the struggle session. And you're like, I don't know, man. I would be much more afraid of an actual struggle session than you know, people were mean to me on Twitter or whatever. But yeah, it's this comparison. Then it's the claim that this is getting worse, right? Like, these may seem like small potatoes, but it's getting worse and it's getting more. What, of course, they don't reflect on is that these kinds of discourses tend to create feedback loops. They tend to create their own positives, right? Like, once you've put it in everyone's head that, like, you can get a lot of attention in the media ecosphere by saying you were canceled, just disproportionately more people will say that that's what happened to them. So these are all sort of the mechanisms. And then the other thing about it is, of course, the mechanisms themselves, they may not work for most people. There are a lot of people who see through them, right? People on Twitter have a lot of fun dunking on these. Be like, what actually happened here, right? But I think the reason that they work is also the secret kind of principle of the thing. The worry about cancel culture started around 2018, 2019, and then really caught on in 2020. And if you think about what happened in between 2018 and 2020, right, about things that have to do with anecdotes and then make broader claims about those anecdotes, right, you have Me Too and you have Black Lives Matter. And to some extent, I think, or I argue in the book, I try to show in the book, that the cancel culture anecdote functions as the antidote, right? It's Me Too for people who are scared of Me Too. People who think that Me Too went too far, but who want to sort of come up with their own anecdotes to invalidate those other anecdotes, right? The same people who want like five more Weinstein accusers before they're like going to believe that he did anything wrong, right? Are like, but can you believe what those kids did at Oberlin, right? And you're like, okay, I see what you're doing, right? You're playing with the relationship between the individual case, right? Because in the end, like, Me Too is to some extent an anecdotal discourse too. It's just like, it's a lot more anecdotes. But like, in the end, we do, when I say Me Too, we do flash back to individual proper names, right? So does someone who's scared of cancel culture. It's actually fairly similar in their mind. It's just that like, the numbers are super low. And as you say, the stakes are far less and far smaller, and especially for Black Lives Matter, right?
You're starting to tap in to what I think is really the overarching novel insight of your book, which is how cancel culture allows a lot of different anxieties to get laundered from sometimes the quite far marginal reaches of the right into our mainstream centrist discourses. Before we get really into the weeds in that, do you want to read?
Should I read? I feel like it's flowing so nicely, but I can read a little bit.
You want to give people a little taste of the product.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the part of the book where I talk about how does this happen, right? Like, one day, you know, you haven't never heard of cancel culture. Suddenly you're like, this is like the third article I'm reading about cancel culture this week, right? How does that process work? And that was the part of the book about that. It's unclear when the term cancel culture was first used on Twitter, but it was first used on Twitter. The term existed in relation to all sorts of things, the tendency to cancel Uber rides, for instance, or TV shows, long before it was used in its contemporary sense. The first tweet that does use it in a way that is at least similar to modern usage dates back to the autumn of 2016. It refers to the alleged relationship between Drake and Taylor Swift and expresses the worry that they would very likely cancel each other in song after they split. So this is a tweet from a Swiftie named @unicorninkk. Ugh, I hate the cancel culture until I want to set things on fire. Okay. Most likely what @unicorninkk meant by that term was the tendency, particularly Taylor Swift's, to devote thinly veiled diss tracks to ex-partners, immediately after breaking up with them, or after being broken up with. Two things seem worth noting here. First, that practice would have corresponded exactly to a description of something else, namely call-out culture that was very common at the time. And second, Unicorn in KK's verdict was explicitly aesthetic. She wasn't worried about freedom of speech. She simply didn't want to hear any more songs of this type. Talk about cancel culture, like the word canceling, originated on Black Twitter, where it was marshaled in defense of various problematic faves, from Jay-Z to R. Kelly and Azalea Banks to Erykah Badu. But it was used as a kind of imminent critique in these fam communities and online spaces. When users complained about cancel culture, they indicated that those who criticized these stars made it too easy on themselves, were too moralistic, too quick to pass judgment, or to declare someone problematic. Importantly, both sides of this debate, those who criticized something as problematic and those who claimed that this critique itself was problematic, were part of the same discursive space. They were fans, for lack of a better term. Blog posts using the word in the summer of 2017 are steeped in the vernacular and preoccupations of Black Twitter and LGBTQ plus bubbles, largely on Tumblr, and largely address users only in those spaces. Up until this point, the diagnosis cancel culture had been part of a larger critique of what is today known as toxic stan Twitter, which is indisputably an unpleasant aspect of online fan cultures, but ultimately something that is true largely of fan cultures. This was about users wanting to make their little corner of the internet a little bit of a better place. Many tweets from 2016 to 2018 have since been deleted, meaning that it's almost impossible to say anything with any certainty about the Twitter discourse on canceling and cancel culture. Nevertheless, and this was true even before Elon Musk completely fucked up the platform, by the way, but nevertheless, until 2018, not a single tweet I could find on the subject, hundreds if not thousands in the spring of 2018 alone, contained the words campus, university, student, or freedom of speech. Cancel culture's big break came in June and July of 2018 with Kanye West. For the first time, a canceled person spoke out about their cancellation, and West also identified a possible second cancellation victim, a man whose ability to present and indeed regard himself as a perpetual victim is perhaps unmatched in the long history of American thin-skinnedness, namely then-President Donald Trump. In an interview with the New York Times, rapper Kanye West used the word canceled 7 times. "I'm canceled," West said, and added, "I'm canceled because I didn't cancel Trump." Here it was, the word from hip-hop fandom, from queer Twitter, threatening both a white conservative man and his most bizarre and devoted fan. The interview appeared on June 25th, and the word was soon everywhere. In relation to Roseanne Barr, YouTuber Logan Paul, and Hollywood actor Kevin Spacey, 3 things are striking about this coming out of the term. First, it seems to have entered the vocabulary of the Trumpists only through the liberal New York Times. Unlike the term political correctness, which was essentially a right-wing psyop that was later adapted by mainstream media, cancel culture was popularized by liberal media. Only in the second step did the right-wingers discover the label as something that they could use. "Everyone is canceled," wrote Jonah Abramowitz in a long article in the style section of the New York Times on June 28, 2018, most likely also to explain to readers the specifics of the Kanye West interview, which probably left a few of them dumbfounded. Abramowitz's article drives home a second point. Early uses in the traditional media did not use the term to diagnose anything new. The early coverage did not treat, for instance, Roseanne Barr's scandal, the uproar over Logan Paul and Kevin Spacey as anything new. What they treated as new was the nomenclature of canceling. Third, the New York Times' early reporting was entirely without any note of panic. Bromwich's article treated the term cancel culture as an online curio. The text clearly referred to internet culture. The author had interviewed academics familiar with the phenomenon. I like that. Such as my colleague Meredith Clark, who's fantastic, and seemed to view everything with a healthy dose of humor and irony. And although Kanye West was always worth a headline in 2018, he wasn't exactly known as a trendsetter, but more as an inveterate eccentric. Less than 4 years later, the same newspaper would warn in a huge editorial about the immense burden of cancel culture. "Gone was the talk of Kanye West or Black Twitter,"
gone were the problematic faves or back chalk, gone were the celebrities and their fans, and gone were the academics. Cancel culture was now about language police and about self-censorship, about the fear of being mistaken for racist or homophobic or sexist. The word, in other words, now evoked all the classic topoi of the political correctness panic of decades past. Had things shifted so fundamentally in public discourse between 2018 and 2022 that such a redefinition of canceling became necessary? This seems very unlikely, especially since the examples offered for cancellation often come from 2017, 2018, or 2019. It seems much more likely that in the discursive explosion that followed the first articles about cancel culture in June and July of 2018, the outlines of the alleged phenomenon began to blur. Or perhaps better, once alienated from the specific discursive spaces, from the specific users that had developed it, the term could be applied to just about everything and anything, and haphazardly integrated into discourse, old and new. In some contexts, cancel culture simply replaced the expression political correctness. In others, it reactivated the panic about speech codes or gave new shape to a nearly 40-year-old fear of identity politics. Precisely because its origins had become so thoroughly repressed, cancel culture was able to mean many things to many different people. It wasn't really a concept anymore. It was a meme. But it was a meme that wasn't allowed to admit that it was a meme. Rather, it had to act as though it still were a highly precise term denoting an acute and clearly defined historic problem. Newspaper readers and Twitter users in the United States witnessed this process firsthand. Many commented on it at the time. What they likely didn't notice, and what many still don't realize, is that in the midst of this very process, the term spilled over into Europe and later Latin America. It did not really make that transition when it was an online-only term, but now it was transferred from US newspapers to German, to French, to Italian print media. The term appears in the London Times for the first time on April 4th, 2019, in an article about Gen Z and the difficulty about marketing to it. The French daily Le Figaro mentions the word on June 13th, 2019, in the paper's culture section, in an article dealing with Woody Allen as a, quote, victim of the cancel culture rampant in the US. Other examples, by the way, are Bill Cosby and Roman Polanski. Real heartbreakers, that one. Okay. The first mentioned in The Australian in Sydney is a column on September 25th, 2019, in connection with a book by the political scientist James Flynn that was canceled by its British publisher. The first mention of the expression cancel culture in Germany was in the center-right Die Welt, in the culture section on July 25th. The occasion, quote, the legendary comedian Louis C.K. has masturbated in front of several women and was banned from stage. Now he is planning his comeback. Okay. The first article in Mexico's Milenio appeared in December 1st, 2019, and was about Woody Allen. In Spain, the first article to use Cultura de Cancelación appeared in El País on December 6, 2019. Its first example are Kevin Spacey being cut out of House of Cards and R. Kelly's concerts being canceled. The first mention of Cultura de Cancelamento in Brazilian media appears to have been in an article about virtual boycott in the Folha de São Paulo. While the article names many examples, it opens with an anecdote about people picketing a screening of a Polanski film. Despite the various national differences, these articles make it relatively clear what version of the term cancel culture was first exported. It traveled the world as an aftershock of Me Too, and above all, Me Too in US media and culture. There was, at least in the beginning, no talk of creeping authoritarianism, no spillover of a new spirit of censoriousness from America to wherever the writer was sitting, no fear of a woke wave that would later come to dominate the imaginaries from Emmanuel Macron to Vladimir Putin. Certainly, there were attempts at making these stories locally relevant. For instance, Le Figaro clearly reported on Woody Allen because the French public has maintained a exceedingly positive relationship, let's say, to Allen for years. But the focus was resolutely on the US. Also notable is the tendency of cancel culture to become a subject for the culture pages and to attach itself to culture issues. As we shall see, whether in France, in Germany, or the UK, the term would make only sporadic appearances in cover stories, in the politics sections, or remarkably, given how US-centric the cancel culture articles were and have remained, even in the foreign affairs section of European newspapers. Rather, the topic was always refracted through the prism of culture. It was about authors and philosophers, statues and films, books and performances. So maybe I'll stop there. Thank you.
What I so love about that section of the book is that you can really see how the imprecision of the term cancel, it allows it to stand in for so many different types of interactions, so many different fears. And you can also see how it's divorced from its original context, where in these sort of self-referential communities online that might be like people of color or very young people or all queer people or maybe some mix of those three, where the term had a degree of like self-conscious irony, right? And then it gets taken away and used with like full seriousness.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting process of de-ironization, right?
Yeah.
As it goes further and further to the right.
So I think that that's what made me reach for the label of moral panic in the first place. I don't know how much everyone knows about that concept. It was introduced in the 1970s by the sociologist Stanley Cohen. And it is about these kind of descriptions that kind of spill over and that the broader culture becomes like convinced, like denote these like really threatening developments to our way of life, our freedom or whatever, or like public decency, public morality, et cetera, et cetera. And a couple of things that they have in common is they usually about young people and they usually don't ask young people, right? It's a bunch of politicians, journalists, members of Congress, like your local sheriff being like, oh, I have heard many of the youths partaking in these kinds of sex parties or
remember rainbow parties?
Rainbow
this thing
parties
that we were told in the 2000s was definitely totally happening. And do you want to tell the story?
I don't know if I want to tell what a rainbow party is. It involved oral sex and lipstick and a sex act that cannot possibly be performed, which like large groups of very serious pundits sort of sat around and debating this without anyone ever being like, wait, does this work? Can you actually do this? How is it done? Is this a non-erasable marker? Because otherwise you can't do this. Anyway, that's one, right? Like people talking about heavy metal music. I recently recorded an episode of a podcast about Dungeons and Dragons. That's another one of these. The Satanic Panic is a pretty classic one of these. And it usually is about the youths and what they're getting up to. And it pointedly, the youths are the last people you ask, right? Because they're already lost. You need that nice man from the sheriff's office to explain it to you. Second thing it does, it grants, right? Like, were there more kids with Satanism tattoos running around the 80s? Like, yeah, they were in bands, right? Like, the thing you can't credit is that the youths might be kidding or that the people you're describing might be ironic. It's like, oh no, they don't understand irony. It's like, no, I think the problem is that you don't understand their irony, right? So this is another aspect of moral panic that I think the cancel culture panic exemplifies perfectly, that you have to impute to your opposite number kind of perfect lack of self-consciousness and irony while yourself being completely unironic and unself-conscious, right? So that to me was like just like the classic moment as I was watching this word. I mean, literally my method in this section is like, you know, I went on LexisNexis and I printed out like 500 articles. And I was like, okay, when is the first time it shows up here? I like did made like maps. I had like a board of crazy with like pins on like a world map. And as I was watching this, I'm like, oh, you're just scared of me too. And you don't feel that great about going to see the latest Woody Allen movie. And you want to make that someone else's problem. Like it became so obvious what it was. And once you trace it, once you sort of narrate it, suddenly the whole thing takes on a totally different shape and appearance. Yeah.
This brings us to something that I really like about the book, which is how it makes it really clear that panicking about cancel culture became like a tool of disavowal, right? To not have to grapple with the thing that you're actually panicking about. Could you like tell us a little bit about that mechanism?
Yeah, right. Like it was a way of kind of getting at Me Too from the side, right? Like, oh, I'm not against Me Too. I understand like what Weinstein is terrible, right? Like, but you don't think that like this cancel culture thing is kind of out of control? Like, well, you said two opposed things just there, right? A lot of this is about language politics and about like the way you can't talk anymore, right? So it's about like language change, and it's specifically about language change that you don't participate in. This is a huge thing in Europe, but it's also in the United States. Like Jordan Peterson, what is Jordan Peterson famous for? Like, I will be canceled when I deadname my students, I guess, at the University of Toronto. And you're like, You have no students, Jordan. Also, like, you know, you got rich dead naming your students. Like, I'm not sure what the problem is here.
People are always saying the thing that they're not allowed to say, like, into a microphone.
Yeah. Or think of, like, pronouns, another one of these, right? Like, the student's going to be illegal to use the wrong pronouns. Like, yeah, sure. Absolutely. That seems like a thing that happens in the world. Let's go with that. And what it is about is, like, actual language change that is voluntary, but that is experienced as conspiratorial because everyone else is doing it and you're not, right? Sometime around May of 2020, a lot of, let's be real, white people in the United States discovered that, like, their neighbors were actually pro-Black Lives Matter and were not horrified by, like, a burning footlocker, but were horrified by what the cops had done to Michael Brown. And, like, there are two ways to, like, deal with that fact. You can either say, like, oh, shit, got to revise some of my priors. Or you can say, it's a conspiracy, I tell you. It's like, they don't really believe that. If they had their druthers, if they could speak openly, they too would say what I would say, but they don't dare. I am the lone, bold truth teller for saying that, like, maybe Michael Brown had it coming, right? Like, my neighbors would say the same thing, obviously, but they have been too cowed by cancel culture, right? Like, so it becomes this way to narrate societal change to you about the young, about the non-white, about the trans, about the LGBT, about the, you know, about the people with they, them pronouns, like, that you do not wish to participate in. It's a way to make your non-participation a bold move, a bold truth-telling move, right? Like, it's not like you're kind of a little stuck in your ways and maybe you should feel sheepish about that. No, you are actually the bold outlier. You're like, not me, wokesters. I will not use your they, them pronouns.
And I think what you're describing here is the way that cancel culture goes, at least in the minds of the people who use it as an accusation, from a critique of liberal excess to a defense of liberal values, right? It allows liberals to be conservative or to argue for conservative positions while at the same time claiming themselves to be the true liberals or the classical liberals.
Right, classical liberals. Exactly. And this is like people who tell me that my book is dangerous and that, like, actually cancel culture is a huge problem. Like, 9 times out of 10, if I click on their bio, it'll be like, neither conservative nor liberal, or like, classical liberal. And you're like, yeah, okay, I get it. But no, you're exactly right. I don't think of it in terms of positions, because I think it's ultimately, like, more about, like, impulses. It's people who conceive of themselves as liberal, but are starting to have conservative impulses on certain things, right? Like, their kid came home with pronouns and now they're like, whoa, okay, right? And, like, they don't know how to feel about it. And, like, basically, right, they're, like, at a crossroads. They can either sort of be like, okay, I'm learning a new thing. Some of it seems good. Some of it seems strange, but it seems fine. Or they can be like, no, it is the children who are wrong. And, you know, and then cancel culture is there for them and it'll be there to articulate for them why they're not being jerks, but really why they're being, the guardians, they're the latter day Alexis de Tocqueville, right? Like, they're standing up for the American commonweal at this point. I mean, what they're literally doing is being a dick to their kids, but, like, no, but, like, isn't the most important thing to be a dick to your kids for democracy, you know?
Right. You're explaining this, like, kind of, like, magnifying feature that it has, right? Because on the one hand, cancel culture panic can take incidents that are, like, incredibly banal and don't matter or are, like, wildly misconstrued and blow them up to have, you know, civilizational consequence in some of this rhetoric. But it can also take these, like, gestures of pettiness or, like, just withholding or, like, willful refusal to understand and blow that up into, like, grand principled defenses, right? So it takes these interactions that are actually just, like, really, like, incredibly low stakes and small, like, small morally, small consequentially, and then turn them into these grand battles of good and evil.
Yeah, there is a kind of secondary narcissism. You get to, like, enjoy yourself, self-portrait at the biggest possible scale, right? Like, I'll say a thing now. I'm going to have a cancelable opinion. Some things that my undergraduates say and do strikes me as dumb and uninteresting. There are things that they do where I'm like, I don't get it. It's not for me.
I'm canceling you, Adrian.
I know.
I'm going to tweet this.
Please. Yeah. I'm being bold right now, right? Like, which I think drives home the point that, like, isn't it awfully convenient when a discourse allows you to think of a thing that mildly annoys you as also the greatest threat to the West since whatever, like Stalinism or something like that, right? Like, that's convenient, right? Like, I hate people cutting me off in traffic. It is now the, right? Like, there's something deeply appealing to like having your own petty gripes be super important, right? You and I have made fun of David Sedaris for this a little bit, of like being like, David Sedaris doesn't like to use the word queer. And he like keeps writing like texts about like, oh, you'll come for me, but I do not believe in the word. I don't want to self-apply the word queer. Like, that's totally fine, David Sedaris. Just like, don't use the word queer. Like, it's really not a big deal. And like, kind of can't help but notice that you keep making it one, right? So that's one thing. The other thing is like, exactly, like, it is a way to like heighten the texture of everyday life. This is not a cancel culture story. This is a cancel culture story of avant la lettre. This is a political correctness anecdote from 1988 from the University of Texas in Austin. I'm not even drawing a blank on who the guy is. He was an English professor, and he was in a lot of these sort of, he was in the Time, the big Time piece on 1992, Thought Police, the new McCarthyism on campus. Like, he's like the first anecdote or whatever. His story is like, I made a couple of comments about like, we were only reading these like Black authors anymore, and we weren't teaching like Melville anymore. And then he didn't use cancellation, but then like my hounding began. And the hounding is like, one colleague who's Black was mean to me at the Xerox machine because I left a bunch of Xerox paper in the Xerox machine. And then they didn't invite me to the Christmas party at another colleague's house, right? And you're like, so just running the tape backwards here, like, someone was mean to an older faculty member at a copy machine. Like, older faculty should not be allowed, another cancelable opinion, near copy machines. I'm sorry. Like, they just keep hitting the button and it just keeps going. And like, you're trying to get your syllabus out. It's terrible. It's terrible. Right. And you didn't get invited to a dinner party. Right. Like, but like, suddenly here it was in like the Chronicle of fucking Higher Education. And I think, not entirely sure of this, but I think it was either Newsweek or in Time. Imagine you're dinner party disinvitation making it into national media. That's remarkable. That's magical. That's wonderful. And like, and maybe these colleagues were even jerks for all I know. Maybe they were mean to him. But it takes these minuscule little blow-ups on college campuses. And this is why I think university professors are particularly susceptible to them, because it says to them the one thing that we cannot resist. Hey, you know how you don't matter at all, and like, you live in this like tiny weird bubble, and like, you're getting older and the students are very scandalously staying exactly the same age. What if that were a big problem? What if this mattered? What if your aging process mattered, right? And you're like, yes, I have thought this myself many a time. Thank you, Mr. Newsweek. I will now write you a 2000 word piece, right? Like, it is fucking catnip for people like me, right? Like, why was I being asked by German, French, British newspapers to write about how I'm scared of my students? Cause that's when I matter, right? I'm like, oh, I would like to write about like Franz Kafka. They're like, fuck Kafka. We're not doing Kafka, right? Like, I want to write about Alfred Dublin. Like, yeah, City Lights takes my call. Like, I can't be in the Atlantic. I'm like, my students won't even read Kafka anymore. Boom. I am printed, right? Like, I think there was literally an Atlantic piece about how our students can't read anymore. Like, 2 weeks ago, I could place that tomorrow. You and I could like do a bunch of blow in Jack Kerouac Alley, pound that thing out, and we are ready. We can like just cash that article.
Adrian, I think you've like discovered our get rich quick scheme.
Oh yeah.
This is what we're gonna do after this.
Oh, it is. I mean, but that's what it is. Like, it destroys proportion. And that can be bad. That's really fucking bad for my students. It was bad for the Stanford IT department that got like death threats, I think, or like really mean emails at least. For like this thing they put on the Slack, they were like, what happened? Right. I interviewed a bunch of them to like find out what happened. And they were all, it's like their first word to me was always like, ugh. Their Christmas was ruined. Right. And for them, it sucks. For the Banh Mi kids in Oberlin, it sucked, but it can also be exciting. And for Jordan Peterson, it made him rich. For some people, it validates their own narcissism. For others, it's just a fun way to get back at their colleagues. Right. Like, for some, it may even be bad. But like, still, the lure is there. Hey, what if we lost all sense of proportion and just kind of blew this the hell up? That's what cancel culture allows us to do.
With that, I think it might be a good time to move to Q&A.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
So before I even ask my question, I got a little lost with a sea of anecdotes and dates and names. You never gave us like a one sentence of what the main argument of your book is. So before I ask my question, I just want to confirm, if I understood correctly, your main argument is that the media and certain portions of society are blowing out of proportion the importance of the cancel culture. Is that?
That's right. I would say that my argument is not that they're blowing out of proportion. They're misdefining it. They're basically creating this object of cancel culture doesn't really exist in that way. There are aspects of this problem that exist, right? People are too easily fired. People online get mad too quickly. That's definitely true. But the moniker cancel culture makes a bunch of assumptions about that that are incorrect. So as an object, it doesn't exist. Yeah.
Okay. So my question is, you just kind of actually addressed that a little bit. So there are people who are losing their jobs. There are people losing their careers. There are people that basically their entire lives tanked because of cancel culture.
Yeah.
Sometimes they didn't even get a chance to defend themselves. And so I'm questioning, how can you kind of be a bit blasé about the whole thing? And not only that, but there seems to be such a chill on what, particularly in your field in academia, what teachers are able to say, write, even the curriculum that they choose.
Yeah.
There are professors who would not accept a female student dissertation as their advisor, their mentor, because they don't want to spend too much time one-on-one with a female student because that could somehow backfire on them. There are all kinds of terrible things as a result of this. So I'm just wondering, how come you think it's all a bit kind of blown out of proportion?
Yeah, it's. I do think it's all blown out of proportion. I'll go in reverse order. The complaint that you can't say anything on college campuses anymore is 45 years old. The claim that certain things cannot be taught anymore is 40 years old. This is the Western canon debate of the 80s. It's not true. You can teach anything you want on a college campus. You know, you may need to defend it, but you can teach anything. You gave the example of the last example. I hadn't heard about dissertations. I have heard about people keeping the door ajar, door open to their office when they are meeting with a female student because the fear is that she might claim sexual harassment, right? Yeah, that would be a problem. That is a very chilling thing. There is a book behind you. There's a Tom Gunn biography right here by Michael Knott that mentions a letter from Tom Gunn mentioning that Ivor Winters warned him about this and said, you should keep your door open when you meet with female students. You don't want to be accused of sexually harassing them. This was, I believe, in 1959. These tropes are old. They are very old. The claim that this is now happening more is a artifact of the fact that we look for this data when we have these modish terms like PC, like cancel culture. And the fact is, these problems have been diagnosed and described since the 1950s. We're always told it's going to get worse and worse and worse. The wolf has not yet shown up. Let's put it this way. Now, I do not say that it's not a problem if someone loses their job, but cancel culture as a term makes a couple of claims. It says, A, people lose it for voicing their opinion. It says, B, it's usually conservative opinions lost because lefties and students have done something. And then the third thing is that it's getting worse, that this is basically something that is a new dimension. Now, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education collects this data. There are sometimes upticks, but the number of people losing their jobs for protected speech until quite recently was extremely steady. It ticked up in 2022. Thanks to Ron DeSantis. The uptick is due to right-wing efforts, and they're not efforts from students. They're efforts from state governments, from governors. And I wouldn't describe that as cancel culture. That's censorship. If my boss fires me, that's not cancel culture, right? Like, if Twitter fires me, yes, I grant you, that would be the definition of cancel culture. If it's the person who signs my paycheck, or if the state legislature wants me gone, that is state-mandated censorship. We have a good word for that. That is a huge problem. I'll grant you that. Is not cancel culture. Second point, the number of people in the FIRE database who have lost their job because of a student effort is minuscule. The number one way, if I want to get fired from Stanford University tomorrow, I can probably do it. the way I would do it is not to piss off my students. I mean, I don't even know what I would do. I could think of some things, but like they would be crimes. They would be crimes. If I want to get really just canned for my speech, piss off a donor, right? Donors tend to be extremely powerful at American institutions, or piss off a state legislature if I'm at a state school, right? Very easy to lose your job that way. They don't tend to be very left-wing. They don't tend to be particularly woke. They tend to be right-wingers who are pissed off about, you know, left-wing speech, right? Another one would be probably to piss off a dean. That's another pretty good thing. Again, not sure that's cancel culture. That is a problem. I wouldn't deny that, but not what we mean by cancel culture, right? Like, so I don't know if I've addressed everything, but I would say that these are my main points. This is a long described problem. The recency bias on this is enormous. And at the same time, it makes us blind to things that really are rising in our society. The FIRE database for something like 2021, 22 is going to have like something like 15 to 20 people losing their jobs at American universities on 5,000 campuses. It's not nothing for these people. That's obviously awful. And I think one case is one too many. I would agree with you on that. At the same time, West Virginia University detenured and fired 140 professors as one university. So cancel culture directs attention. I'm not here to tell you that campuses are a great place to live and be, right? Like there's a lot amiss on American campuses. What cancel culture does is direct our attention to certain things that happen on college campuses, and they make us blind to others. And I would argue that the threat that emanates from a man like Ron DeSantis, that comes from university presidents like the one at West Virginia University, that comes from people trying to take LGBT content out of libraries, is far greater, and the numbers bear this out, than by students who say, I don't like that this professor used the N-word in class, right? So sorry, it's a long answer, but you really did rehearse a lot of what I talk about in the book. And it's, I think the book is written with people like you in mind, because I can sense your worries and I think they're justifiable worries. But I think that you do not serve those worries well by attaching them to the label cancel culture. You will get misinformed and your attention will be misdirected, is my suspicion. And that's what I expressed in the book.
Nancy asks, could you expand on what you said about how cancel culture can be used to take reactionary stands on new ideas and make it seem heroic?
Yeah. The best example of this, although this is not just limited to language change, but one would be language change, right? Like refusing to go with a change in the language, right? And this was very key to like the PC panic of the 90s, right? Like, well, it may not be PC, but I still use the word whatever. And then it's what, basically, what you're doing in that moment, you're just talking the way you've always talked, but you're in that moment, right? Think of how many comedy specials in the 90s were called politically incorrect, right? Like people made their money being like, folks, I'm not particularly politically correct. I still say this word and that word, like, and you can take it from my cold dead hands or whatever, right? Like, so it's a way to monetize and to kind of to exceptionalize, right? Like, language change is a tricky thing. Some of it we go along with and some of it we don't. Sometimes because we don't want to, and some of it because we kind of can't figure it out, right? Like there's just like, I'm not learning this. This is too complicated, right? There's a moment when you're just like, I don't care enough, right? To like learn this. But what the PC label did was kind of give you a vocabulary for casting that in a heroic mold. But that's true for a lot of things, right? A lot of people who present themselves as cancel victims in public discourse have attained a certain level in their particular fields. We don't tend to speak of cancel culture when someone gets fired from Starbucks, for instance, right? Cancel culture happens to editors. It happens to very famous journalists. It happens to the Matt Lauers. It happens to your studio heads. It happens to famous authors, right? It happens to professors, right? It doesn't happen to graduate students. That's just called being fired, right? It's a way to cast their clinging on to existing hierarchies as something heroic, right? What they're saying is like, I shouldn't have been kicked out because like, I am too important. I was the best editor that picking something at random here, New York Review of Books ever had. You know, how dare you, right? And so in some way, that's a structurally conservative argument. It says our hierarchies are there for a reason. People who have power in our society have it for a reason. And you are wrong to try and take it away from them, right? Absolutely fine position, but it is a conservative position. But cancel culture allows you to cast that not as a conservative defense of the principle of hierarchy, but as a heroic stance for individual liberty, right? Cancel culture is a fairly libertarian discourse. It treats Twitter like state overreach. It's saying there's other people have too much power over us. We want to be more independent. In the end, though, it is a deeply community-dependent discourse because it says, hey, remember that power you invested in me 10 years ago? I deserve that. The power they withdrew from me last year, I didn't deserve that, right? So it does become this kind of funny mix of a libertarian conservatism and this kind of heroic individualism.
Leia asks, what's your take on how these moral panics die, or at least subside back down to a baseline? When funding dries up for Barry Weiss and Peterson type figures, or just that each term, political correctness, cancel culture, woke, etc., gets hollowed out and runs out of energy?
That's a great question. There's one part I can answer. Barry Weiss and Jordan Peterson will never run out of funds. This is part of what has sustained this panic for so long in its new guises. There is right-wing donor money attached to it, and there are people who make their living getting paid by that right-wing donor money. Like, I know that sounds a little conspiratorial, but all I'm saying is, like, there is someone drawing a paycheck at the Heritage Foundation, bundling campus anecdotes. That person is going to keep doing that as long as the checks roll in, and Heritage has an interest in keeping that going, right? So I think that is part of the problem. But the other parts of this are more complicated. I do think that they run out of steam fairly quickly. Stanley Cohen said that basically he thought that moral panics really exhaust themselves fairly quickly just because that level of emotional pitch can't be sustained. Now, I would say Stanley Cohen, me, Twitter, right? Like, you can... We can sustain emotional pitch a lot better in the online age, and that's a problem, right? So I think these run longer. I do think what makes Leah's question so interesting is I think that as I'm talking about this moral panic, I think it is running out of steam. I think we're kind of getting to the tail end of it, and you're starting to see kind of attempts to rebrand it. There is already a French candidate for a replacement, right? So cancel culture came to France, didn't succeed very well because the French think culture is a good thing. So, like, they don't like the cancel culture. It has to be this canceling. And then they got le wokisme, and they're like, yes, nous aimons le wokisme. And so they have like 40 books appeared on le wokisme in like 1 year. And then they have a new concept, and that's Islamo-gauchisme. So Islamo-leftism. And you're starting to see Islamo-leftism crop up in like the British Spectator and like sort of the far right rags in the UK. That might be the next one. And you're starting to see the points about, like, oh, aren't our universities secretly in league with Hamas? Like, you're starting to see that sort of on Barry Weiss's Substack and that kind of thing. So that would be my guess. That's the next one that's kind of warming itself up. It's like doing stretches courtside, and it's like, put me in, coach, right? And like, I wouldn't be shocked if that's the next one. DEI was a brief one. It didn't really sort of like, didn't seem to work that well. I'm still not sure why some run out of juice faster than others. It's really kind of interesting. And we do have the gift of Chris Rufo, who is like narrating, seeding these things. And is like, yeah, it didn't work. We tried the other one, right? Like, I found this like on the Seattle public something or other, like public web, and like tried that one out for a while, right? So Rufo is fantastic and sort of like kind of just talking you through the process. But that guy can't make this happen by himself. These things work when non-right-wingers agree that this is a problem, right? So I don't quite know how that spark flies over and how it works. I think that there is some element where I can sort of show in the book, like, this is how this works. And this kind of ping-pong effect where, like, the U.S. provides the examples and the anecdotes and the phrases for some time, and then, like, the French can sort of take it over and volley it back. Remember when like American conservatives got freaked out about gender? Like, Europe had had that panic for like 5 years prior. Europeans were like, whoa, like, did you guys just like steal our thing? Like, we didn't know that it worked that way. And like, yeah, it's bidirectional, right? But then there are other aspects of it that are frankly kind of mysterious. My guess is a lot will depend on where the Republican Party goes in the next, you know, 12 months. But like, this isn't independent. Just because I isolated in this and sort of just tried to sort of like have pins on a map and like on a calendar, like, I understand this doesn't happen in a vacuum. This is deeply entwined with political actors who have their own thing going, right? Like, Ron DeSantis doesn't care about cancel culture. He cares about getting reelected. Other people care about selling newspapers. Other people care about like not losing their job at the Heritage Foundation. Other people care about like spending their gigantic fortune that they inherited and that they like need to blow through somehow, right? Like, everyone has a different set of priorities they bring to it. And as those realign and shift, I mean, one thing I think that could dial these down is that the stock market took a tank. It might be as easy as that. a lot of these places function from endowments. Like, I know Stanford is suddenly like a lot less interested in like seeding new AI institutes when like our endowments in the toilet. But like, I could imagine that like people are like, well, the culture war stuff's not as important. Let's lower taxes kind of thing. So I'm sorry that I'm giving kind of a scattered answer, but the problem is there are a lot of things that flow into this. And any of these dials could be determinative in like how long these things last, what they get succeeded by, and how the transition looks.
First of all, thanks. I really appreciated the particularly the answer to the questions. I think the sides are clear. I think it's the people in the middle that I wanted you to have a little more empathy with in the conversation. Polanski, Woody Allen, to me, they're people I want to talk about. That's more confusing. Like, it's not as clear-cut as other people.
Yeah,
I didn't know quite where you were going with, I have two daughters, this issue of pronouns, the issue of gender comes up, they're at that age. How do you have that conversation as a parent? When you talk about the kind of flippant nature of both left and right-wing media, I think about the power of a movie like Tar, which I thought was brilliant, but like actually confused me now based on this conversation. I'm thinking like, well, that movie really affirmed to me that there was an issue in colleges. I was thinking it was so well made and it was Hollywood and someone wrote it and people put money into it. So I think where I sit is I appreciate particularly the response to this question and a little bit of the last. But in the middle ground, we want to be able to have the conversation about cancel culture, because I think I felt you were a little flippant earlier. You both were. Cancel culture does exist. And I think it's helpful to frame it for us a little more like people take advantage of it. How much should we be worried about it? You know, and it's very useful, this part of the conversation.
Well, yeah. At the same time, to go back to another moral panic, and this is, again, sorry, I'm keep coming back to this term, but I think it does help clarify something, right? Like, there was in the 80s a moral panic about stranger abductions. Now, like, there were stranger abductions and it was a huge problem. It was not a numerically huge problem, but like, I mean, I have a child and like, it's the worst thing I could possibly imagine, right? That doesn't mean that the discourse about it was helpful, right? Because it often directed people's attention towards things that were useless, right? The famous strangers with candy or your like unmarked white vans, and away from things that people should be paying more attention to, like weird Uncle So-and-so who like kind of keeps hanging out with the kids at Thanksgiving and the kids don't seem that comfortable with him, right? Like, so I think we're quibbling over definitions here. Like, I'm saying the cases and the difficulties and the awkwardnesses and the problems you describe are real. But I think the moment you group them in that way, I think there are certain things that fall under the table. It's like a three-card Monty, right? Where you like make the thing fall behind the table, right? Like, there's something already falling out of the discussion by the time you've committed to saying there is this one thing called cancel culture. Well, we can probably say you already gave a good list of things that you feel leery about. And I think if you just stick with that list, you're actually much better off, because some of these things are similar to each other. Some are not, right? Like, as I say, language change is one thing, right? Gender is another, right? That can be about language change, but it is not necessarily about language change. The intergenerational aspect, the fact that there's some aspects of our children's lives, and now I have a three-year-old, I'm not anywhere near in the position you're in, I'm guessing, in terms of experiencing the alienation of like this person that I knew everything about, I now am starting to have serious doubts about, like, I don't, there are parts of their lives that are just inaccessible to me. Naming that is important, and sitting with that awkwardness and sitting with the ambiguities of that is very powerful. Whether or not it gains anything by being connected to these other things, or whether that moralizes it too much and sort of makes it such that one way, one side or the other, right? Either you who says cancel culture is real, or let's say the other side that says like it's not. I guess another question, like whether or not to just sit with, hey, there's this thing that we find difficult to talk about, and maybe we have to talk about the difficulty, right? I'm not sure what you gain from saying, and that is indicative of a broader thing in this culture, such as, right, Roman Polanski. Like, what Roman Polanski did is entirely separate from the difficulty of talking to one's children, right? Like, so I would say in some way, being open and honest about lists and just saying, like, here's some things I've noticed, let's take them one by one, is probably more helpful than trying to group them under this kind of modish moniker, I would say. To give you one example, there was between 2020 and 2022, a very strange spate of firings at Starbucks of people who had served coffee to police officers, and the police officers went on Twitter and said, this person wrote pig on my Starbucks cup. And the people invariably got fired. Starbucks, being a corporate employer, obviously hates bad publicity. Turns out no one wrote pig on someone's Starbucks cup. This didn't happen. There were like 20 cases like this. It's not huge, right? But like 20 cases. None of them I've ever seen discussed as cancel culture, right? Even though it would fit. And that's what I mean. Being fired from your job at Starbucks sucks, right? Like losing an editorship for an academic journal, like you're not losing any money, but like these people lost their livelihood, right? But it's not discussed as cancel culture because A, the people accusing were police. We tend to credit police more than we credit an undergraduate who said, this person said a slur to me. And because it sort of didn't fit, right? It didn't fit the story. And that's what I mean, right? The movie Tar is about a person who, in a brutal way, I mean, unless I misunderstood the movie, like abused her power, right? And drove someone to suicide, right? Like, I agree there are thorny issues raised by that movie, but I wouldn't want to connect it to like not knowing how to use pronouns. That person is making a perfectly human mistake. Lydia Tarr in the movie Tarr is somewhere beyond a perfectly understandable error. We could still have to say, does she deserve what happens to her in the movie? But it's on a different register. So that's what I would plead for. Context dependence, specificity, local knowledge, right? Situating it not in this international story of cancel culture, but in the very lived experience of what it's like to be in an American workplace, what it is to like to be in an American university, what it's like to be in an American family, right? And suddenly the empathy, suddenly the knowledge, suddenly the context comes back in that I find cancel culture tends to magically make go away. Sorry, it's a long answer, but that would be my answer. Be comfortable with lists and saying they feel similar to me, but I acknowledge they're not 100% similar, right?
I think we have time for one more.
This is going to bring it down a notch. A little niche. I'm really curious about how you went about researching the book.
Yeah.
How you collected the information, what information you sought.
Yeah.
Could you quantify it? Were you able to quantify it? And finally, you alluded to Twitter changing. Like, what challenges did you face when that changed?
Yeah. Having the main place where a word you're studying is being used be acquired by a man-child that destroys the API, not recommended. 0 out of 10 would not recommend, right? That was bad. At the same time, I'm leery of using Twitter for this kind of stuff anyway, on account of like, people also delete a lot of tweets. There are a lot of people who automatically delete their tweets. I basically, in the book, you kind of heard me do it. I sort of said, this is what I found. That's the best I could do. I didn't quantify anything. I sort of said, Twitter was wonky even before Elon Musk showed up on this stuff. I basically tried to sort of double check, triple check things constantly. What I did was cite individual instances and then say like, here's what I found, here's what I didn't find. That is a qualitative method that I wouldn't recommend, but like, unlike something like YouTube, which has good API, I found Twitter very difficult to work with. What I did end up doing is kind of make a timeline, just sort of see like, how often am I seeing this, right? When's my first French tweet? When is my first German tweet? When's my first tweet that's clearly from a UK vantage point? When has J.K. Rowling's name first come up, right? It's not perfect, right? Like, could there have been someone who went on a spree a month prior and I don't have it? Yeah, absolutely possible. And then I sort of try to do sort of macro trends because I feel like with Twitter, you can't put too much weight on it. So you just have to kind of go in the big picture and say like what I was saying, like I didn't find university. That seems interesting. Often it's easier to talk about an absence than about what's there, right? So that's the Twitter piece of it. I'm sorry if I can't give you a very good example. YouTube is the great counterexample. I'm working right now on an academic piece on the Depp-Heard trial on YouTube. YouTube is a dream. Someone made an app that rips every comment ever made on a video. It's beautiful. It takes like an hour. It's fantastic. I mean, you have to still make sure it didn't like misread something that can happen, but like very rare. It's very, very good. But if this had been a YouTube phenomenon, I would have like jumped in the air and loved it. What was the first methods question yet? My general method. My general method really was my number one source was LexisNexis. I looked through where it showed up in newspapers, and then I would subscribe to certain newspapers that kept coming up to double check, because LexisNexis does not index every, like, right? Some that want to get rich on their own, like, kind of opt out of it. And so I would sort of double check and be like, make sure I wasn't kind of off entirely. I would do analysis of like which sections in the newspaper this came in. I would ask who the most frequent writers were. I would look into what was the picture? What did the picture legend say about like, right? Because it's often the stuff that the editor writes, right? Like not the writer themselves. So that's kind of, that can tell you sort of where the paper's at, right? Especially with dailies where this stuff happens very quickly. People kind of can be unconsciously revealing of like, what's the first thing they think of as cancel culture, right? Like shit, it's 11:55 PM. We're going to print in half an hour. What's our picture, right? Like, oh, Roman Polanski, right? Like it is really, really telling what they reach for in that moment, right? Because like that's when we can be at our most unguarded in some way, when like five people get together and they're like, quickly, someone say something cancel it, right? That was something I would do. The other thing I did was, is this going to be on YouTube?
Yeah.
Okay. Some other things involved copyrighted material that I will not go into now. My method was large corpus analysis, right? The number one observation I made about cancel culture discourse was how much there was of it. And I thought, I'm going to use that. I'm not going to say what one person thought. I'm not going to say what Yasha Munks thought. I'm going to say what Ann Applebaum thinks. I'm not going to say what Barry Weiss thinks. I'm going to try and see what these people say in the aggregate. And for that, luckily, in the age of the algorithm, we do have large corpus analysis. My method was to accumulate large text databases and then run analysis on them and sort of look for co-occurrences, frequencies. There's something called collocation. So like, what is the word within five words of the word to cancel in an article? What's the most likely word to show up? That's the kind of thing. I didn't end up writing most of that in the book, but that's what's behind. That's how I analyze these things. That's how you sort of start noticing these patterns. That's where I noticed that like, yeah, at some point, the Europeans became convinced that cancel culture was not about politicians. It's not about publishing. It's not about journalism. It was about the arts, right? And that's when I could sort of pinpoint, like, this is when they started being convinced about the fact that it was about the university, right? Like, and you could show that, like, 2 months prior, no one seemed to think it was about the university, right? And you can say that with a greater degree of confidence if you have these large corpora at your disposal, which I did. In non-copyright violating ways. So does that answer your question, or do you want me to go more granular?
Yeah. Well, we have run out of time. So Adrian, congratulations again on a very compelling book.
And thank you so much.
Moira, thank you for doing the honors. And thanks to all of you in the audience for joining us and those of you online.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Peter. Thank you, Moira.
In Bed with the Right, we'd like to thank the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research for generous support, Jennifer Portillo for setting up our studio. Our producer is Katie Lyle.